they thought the story was over. Napoleon Bonaparte had been removed from the center of Europe and placed somewhere deliberately small. An island, a boundary, a pause. The kind of ending history prefers because it feels tidy. Exile creates that illusion. It suggests closure. It tells the world that authority has been stripped, that equilibrium has been restored, that the system has corrected itself. But exile does not erase identity. On Elba, Napoleon still wakes as Napoleon. He still thinks like a commander. He still scans for weakness, opportunity, misalignment. The loss of power has not dissolved his sense of authorship over events. It has merely interrupted it. An interruption is not the same as acceptance. From the outside, Europe moves on. Borders are redrawn. Alliances reorganize. Institutions adapt to a world without him. From the inside, something else is happening. Welcome to the Members in the Room podcast, where we share real-life stories about leadership and their underlying human behavior rooted in science and research. We unpack and interpret the evolutionary forces behind it to help you to better lead your people for outstanding business results. Welcome back to the Members in the Room, where we explore leadership lessons that stand the test of time, using history to explain what's really happening beneath human behavior and why the same forces that shaped empires still play out inside modern organizations today. I'm Nicholas Bocconi, CEO of Mammoth Leadership Sciences. This is the final chapter of Napoleon's journey. Not the fall, that already happened. Not the exile, we've seen that too. This episode is about the return. And what happens when a leader who has lost structural power still believes in the rules that once rewarded them? About what happens when confidence survives authority, when reputation outruns reality, and when the world no longer responds the way it once did. Napoleon's escape from Elba is often described as daring, reckless, improbable. From Napoleon's point of view, it feels logical. Elba is not a prison in the way defeat is supposed to be. Napoleon governs the island. In fact, under the Treaty of Fontainebleau, he was not a prisoner, but the recognized ruler of the 86 square miles island, which, by the way, is unbelievably beautiful. I was a couple of times there on vacation. Fantastic. Napoleon has his own small army, his navy, and even a flag. He issues orders, he inspects troops, he is still addressed as emperor. The rituals of authority remain, even as the substance thins. And rituals matter. They keep identity intact long after power has been stripped away. Just as today, look at the constitutional monarchy in the UK. Same thing. No power. Lots of rituals. And privileges. But there is something even more important, the signals coming from France do not feel final. The restored monarchy is fragile and loyalty is uneven. Veterans grumble and old networks steer, and nothing feels settled or locked in. The environment that once produced Napoleon does not appear fully extinguished. And this matters because Napoleon has always interpreted instability as opportunity. And therefore, he frames the escape from Elba not as a rebellion, rather as correction. In his mind, he's not defying history. He is resuming it. And the early signs seem to confirm his belief. As he lands in southern France and begins moving north, resistance dissolves instead of hardening. Units sent to stop him hesitate, then defect, then join him. Soldiers who once fought under his command respond to familiarity, shared identity, and remembered status. Momentum returns quickly, just enough to feel decisive. And that is a very dangerous phase of leadership recovery. We see that today in businesses as well. CEOs are ousted, then hired somewhere else and starting to do the same things all over. And the reason is that partial, initial success feels like proof. Basically, an early validation, which is interpreted as confirmation that the underlying conditions have not changed. The leader concludes that the same rules still apply and that the same instincts still work, that the system is simply waiting to realign around a familiar center. But what Napoleon is experiencing is not structural restoration. It is recognition without reinforcement and loyalty without durability and momentum without depth. The environment cooperates just enough to disguise how much has changed. By the time Napoleon reaches Paris, crowds gather, officials defect, and banners reappear. Napoleon re-enters the capital not as a conqueror, but as a familiar solution. This period becomes known as the Hundred Days, a brief moment where authority appears to snap back into place with astonishing ease. To Napoleon, this looks like restoration. The system responds. Orders are obeyed. Soldiers rally. The symbols of power reassemble around him with practiced efficiency. The past appears paused, not erased. But something subtle has changed. The loyalty he receives is broad, but shallow. It's emotional rather than institutional. He gets applause, but commitment? Not really. Many align with him not because they believe in a renewed empire, but because they fear being on the wrong side of momentum. Napoleon interprets this alignment through the lens that has always guided him. He reads enthusiasm as endorsement, speed as stability, visibility as legitimacy. He still believes he can shape events through presence and decisiveness, but the conditions that once amplified his instincts have tightened because time is compressed. He has fewer allies and the tolerance is lower. And yet, early validation is intoxicating as applause creates certainty. Don't we all love applause? It tells leaders the system wants them back, that authority remains intact, that resistance will dissolve if momentum is applied decisively enough. But applause is not structure. While Paris responds with emotion, the rest of Europe responds with memory. During Napoleon's earlier rise, Europe was divided, coalitions hesitated, rival powers misjudged one another, and fragmentation was the rule. That world no longer exists. The moment news of Napoleon's return spreads, the response is immediate and coordinated. There are no debates about intent, no uncertainty about threat, no illusions about negotiation. The coalition does not ask what Napoleon wants. It remembers what Napoleon does. This is what experienced systems learn to do. They stop reacting to words and start reacting to patterns. In fact, let me rephrase, they start predicting the patterns which will repeat themselves. For years, European leaders had absorbed the cost of underestimating Napoleon. However, he, Napoleon, is still operating with an internal map shaped by earlier success. He expects hesitation, the same fractures of the past, the same time to react. These expectations are not irrational. They are based on lived experience. In his past, pressure created disorder, speed overwhelmed coordination, force produced compliance. But the environment has adapted. Coalition leaders now act with a shared frame. Napoleon is no longer a negotiable actor. He's a structural threat. Coordination is faster because the goal is simpler. Prevent consolidation before momentum becomes irreversible. This is where misalignment becomes visible. Napoleon still believes he is shaping the tempo. In reality, the tempo has been set without him. Now, let's talk about Waterloo. Well, Waterloo is remembered as a single day, the single famous battle, the single famous defeat. But from leadership perspective, there is something way more sophisticated to learn, as it exposes something very uncomfortable about leadership. Leaders are successful when their intent, strategy, tactics, execution align with the environmental conditions. Leaders fail when they come with their horse to a race and find out others are driving cars. And at Waterloo, Napoleon encounters his limits. The battle was fought on a Sunday, June 18, 1815, near Waterloo in present-day Belgium. Napoleon's French army, around 70,000 soldiers, was defeated by the 7th Coalition, comprising a British-led Allied army under the Duke of Wellington with around 70,000 soldiers, and Prussian forces under Gebhard von Blücher with 50,000 soldiers. The battle saw brutal fighting, with a pivotal moment occurring when the Prussian army arrived in the afternoon to attack the French flank and the failure of Napoleon's elite Imperial Guard to break the Allied line, resulting in a general panic and collapse of the French army. Can you imagine the guy who outmaneuvered everyone, finally outmaneuvered by the ones who learned from him how to move, how to react, how to counter, how to be quick? The battle, goodness, was extremely bloody, with over 50,000 soldiers dead on that day, on that very Sunday. After Waterloo, collapse is immediate. British, Prussian, Austrian, and Russian leaders act in concert. Armies advance, borders harden, negotiations close. What follows is removal from relevance. Napoleon is transferred to St. Helena, chosen for silence, distance, and irrelevance. The world Napoleon once dominated reorganizes without reference to him. And that is how Napoleon's narrative arc closes. Now, let's take a moment and talk about cross-episode leadership learnings. What Napoleon ultimately teaches us about power. When Napoleon's story is viewed as a whole, the temptation is to search for a single cause, a fatal flaw, a decisive error, a moment where everything turns. That temptation misses the point. Napoleon does not rise because he's flawless. He rises because his instincts fit the environment of his time. And across these episodes, a pattern becomes clear. Napoleon succeeds when his confidence matches uncertainty. He dominates when momentum outpaces coordination. He thrives when systems are fragile and coalitions divided. And he begins to fail, not when his character changes, but when the environment does. Here is a learning for us. For us in our organizations we lead today. Leadership is not a permanent state. It is a temporary alignment between human behavior and external conditions. When leaders mistake past success for timeless validity, they stop sensing change at the edges. They trust what once worked, even as the world moves on. Napoleon's story endures not because it is extraordinary, but because it is human. Every organization, every institution, every leader eventually faces this test. Not whether they can rise, not whether they can succeed, but whether they can recognize when the environment is changing before confidence becomes constrained. And that is why Napoleon's story still matters. Because the same forces that shaped his decisions, confidence under uncertainty, sensitivity to momentum, loyalty, threat, and status are still shaping decisions today. In boardrooms, in governments, in teams. History does not repeat itself, but human behavior does. And that's the mammoth in the room. All right, if this episode resonated with you, as a leader, a student of history, or someone curious about how power really works, please subscribe, rate, and share it with someone who would appreciate this perspective. And if you want to go deeper, you can order my book. It has the same title as this podcast, The Mammoth in the Room. It is a practical roadmap how great leaders and their teams embrace evolutionary truths for outstanding business results. And it does that in three sections, on people, on strategy, and on implementation. Until next time. Lead wisely, think critically, and don't let ancient instincts hijack your modern leadership. I'm Nicholas Bocconi, and this is The Mammoth in the Room. Thank you for listening. If you enjoy this content, don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you on the next episode of The Mammoth in the Room.